From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. We talk with a very special Georgia band today.
Let's have bizarre celebrations. Let's forget who, forget why, forget where. We'll have bizarre celebrations.
That's Wraith Pinned to the Mist and Other Games by the Athens Band of Montreal. We talk with the group's leader, Kevin Barnes, this hour. But first, we want to hear from you. On Second Thought host Celeste Headlee is leaving this daily program, and we are playing some of her best segments over the next week. What are some of your favorite music segments that Celeste presented? Give us a call and leave a message. Let us know what you want to hear. 404-500-9457. You can also post to Facebook or Twitter. We're at OST Talk. And remember that we might feature your comments on the show. For the last couple years, the Atlanta chapter of the Satanic Temple has worked to host an after-school program for kids in Cobb County. That caused some controversy. My colleague Celeste talked about this with Fred Mephisto, who heads the Atlanta chapter of the Satanic Temple.
Hello.
Is Mephisto your actual last
name? No, it is
name?
Not. due to good sense, I use a pseudonym and not my actual name. That keeps the bricks through the window down.
So there is this accusation that members of the Satanic Temple aren't Satanists at all, but are mostly atheists who are trying to fight for separation of church and state. How accurate is that?
Well, I don't think that it's mutually exclusive categorizations there. We are certainly an activism group for separation of church and state. However, I don't think that invalidates us as a religion. Certainly our tenets are deeply held personal beliefs. You know, we consider ourselves a non-theistic religion in that we don't believe in a deity or deities, we don't find a need to explain the universe with supernatural explanations. But nevertheless, we certainly feel that we qualify legally and conceptually as a religion. That said, we certainly think that we can be a religion as well as advocate for separation of church and state issues.
So let me read the Satanic Temple's mission statement here. Quote, "The mission of the Satanic Temple is to encourage benevolence and empathy among all people, reject tyrannical authority, advocate practical common sense and justice, and be directed by the human conscience to undertake noble pursuits guided by the individual will." Now, how does an after-school program fit into that mission statement?
Well, we believe that the existence of Christian and evangelical after-school programs is, first of all, a violation of separation of church and state. Now, that's predicated on 2001 Supreme Court decision of Good News Club versus Milford Central School. But our position is that there really should be more fundamental and total separation of church and state. Now, given that that is already not the case, it's in our part of our mission to provide an alternative to the existing clubs, whereas there currently is no alternative. We don't feel as though that it's the prerogative of religion to be able to proselytize in the public domain like that, especially at a public school.
Okay, so here's a little clip of a report from WSB-TV on this controversy.
As some describe, the Satanic Temple is a group of political activists, and their main priority, the separation of church and state. But parents who send their kids to school here that we talk to really don't like that name, regardless of what the group says it means.
So, okay, oftentimes in other states, the Satanic Temple has sued schools that include Christian programs and sued.
We've yet to actually file a lawsuit.
The Satanic Temple?
We have not, on this issue, we have not filed any lawsuits. We're kind of developing our strategy for that right now, but so far, in some cases.
On the issue of after-school
programs.
Correct.
There have been other lawsuits,
right,
such as the Baphomet Monument in Oklahoma with the Ten Commandments Monument and things like that. But
right.
We haven't actually filed any suits on
very,
that.
And what I'm trying to say is that in other cases with lawsuits, the thing that has, in the end, this name that parents find objectionable has often been what made the lawsuit successful. In other words, the law protects all religions.
Correct.
And allows equal access for all religions.
Correct.
Meaning that if you have
the ones you don't like.
Right. So if you have the Ten Commandments monument up, the Satanic Temple says, well, then we want to put up our statue of Baphomet.
Exactly. I mean, we're just trying to, we show up when the law does not seem to be applied evenly or correctly. And that only one organization has applied for a Ten Commandments monument is oftentimes used as an excuse to allow only that monument. However, once we file an application, you can no longer say, well, there is nobody else actually desiring to put up a monument and so forth. So we kind of put it to the test. You know, we put the religious equality question to the test by showing up and trying to follow an exact replication of the steps followed by other groups, their application process for the after-school club, for the monument, and so forth. We just try and copy what they do and see if they are actually applying separation of church and state, or not even separation of church and state, equal representation by the Establishment Clause in public domain.
So the National Satanic Temple Organization also even created a coloring book, a satanic coloring book for kids to offer because they had had a Bible coloring book at a school in Florida.
Right, absolutely. When they were handing out religious indoctrination materials at an elementary school, we simply just generated a very, you know, it's not proselytizing our materials.
No, it's actually pretty.
Yeah, I mean the only
reason, through the whole thing. There's nothing objectionable.
The only reason someone could not like it is if you don't like the word Satan. You know,
right.
There's very little, and the same applies to our after-school curriculum. There's nothing that a sensible person can find objectionable in there, as long as just the simple name of our organization isn't found to be objectionable in itself.
Well, many people find that objectionable.
Sure, absolutely.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Fred Mephisto. He's the Atlanta chapter head for the Satanic Temple. And we're talking about the effort to get a after-school program led by the Satanic Temple in Cobb County schools. And you were beginning to talk about the curriculum. So what is in the curriculum for the after school?
At this point, we haven't published the curriculum outside of areas that are actually holding the club, partly because other similar organizations have not been asked to show their curriculum in advance of getting the application. So we keep that fairly, you know, under tight wraps just to follow the process that has been set forth by other organizations. They haven't been asked to show their curriculum before they are approved, so we kind of keep that a little bit of a guarded secret. That said, if you were to read it, I mean, it's very straight to the point in terms of critical thinking, community involvement, secular morality, and things to that effect, you know, scientific rationalism. We're certainly not teaching children how to worship Satan. We don't even believe in Satan. There's no indoctrination or proselytization. We're really just trying to offer a very secular, morality-oriented alternative to the evangelical clubs, which already exists in the places we've applied.
Without giving anything away, I wonder if it's similar to the coloring book we referenced.
It's
you know,
be
there
similar.
Was a word search in the activity book that was we were looking for words like friends and love and happiness and acceptance.
And there's lessons about not bullying, and they actually, rather than you know, censure the bully kid, they kind of educate him through the process of the coloring book, you know, how he ought to be more friendly to everyone. So, I mean, it's pretty wholesome stuff, really, when you get down to it.
Do you have kids?
I do not have kids.
Do other members of the Satanic Temple
Other members of the Satanic Temple definitely have kids.
And did they contribute to the thoughts on this after-school program?
Sure. We have parents who are members of the chapter, members of the national organization, you know, there's people in Cobb County who are interested and involved. So, you know, we certainly include parents in our membership.
All right. So then what has the effort been? If your point was to try and see if there was equal access for all religions to these kind of programs, has that turned out so far to be true?
So far, that hasn't been the case. Now, since applying in, I believe, the beginning of August, we have communicated a little back and forth with Cobb County, but we really haven't received a meaningful response to the application itself. We've gone back about a little bit of kind of procedural stuff and some questions like what's the address of our organization and so forth. But really, as far as any actual answers, yes or no, can we hold the club? We really haven't heard any word. And, you know, 6 months certainly seems like plenty of time for that kind of extreme low-level decision to be made by the Cobb County School Board. It's my belief that they are just stalling and kind of calling our bluff and waiting to see if we're going to follow through. And, you know, to their credit, so far that's working in that we haven't actually held the club. But we consider that a de facto denial of our application, which, you know, we think is the grounds for a religious discrimination lawsuit.
And are you prepared? I mean, that's what they
definitely are prepared. I mean, I nobody more so than me. However, unfortunately, I'm not a lawyer. So I do depend on sort of the good advice and the timing of our legal defense groups, such as Americans United for Separation of Church and State. They're heavily involved, ACLU to some degree. So these guys, you know, I mean, I can't, you know, snap my fingers and have them act on my behalf at any moment. But, you know, things are in the works, and we're kind of planning our strategy here. There's several other cities in which similar treatment has been given to the application, and we're kind of crafting our strategy, which is inclusive of all of those other cities as well. So it may not be Atlanta that's a lawsuit is filed initially, because we want to try and set a precedent without spending so much resources and filing in multiple cities. But like I say, I mean, from our point of view, we're kind of just waiting on our legal defense guys to get to us on their long list since the recent election.
What if the Cobb County Schools comes to you tomorrow and says, okay, this is approved. The Satanic Temple can do an after-school activity. Are you prepared to do
that? Yeah. I mean, you know, when we first applied for the facility use, we were ready to go that afternoon, you know. 6 months of kind of attrition, we're just sort of waiting, and I'd have to kind of rally the troops again. But I mean, we're fundamentally ready to go at any moment. You know, we've got our materials in hand. I've got volunteer background check volunteers, most of whom have an education background and things like that. So, you know, we're kind of just waiting for the green light and have been for a while.
Do you say, I mean, I've looked at a lot of the material from the Satanic Temple, and as you say, it doesn't proselytize. There's nothing in there telling people to worship Satan. But does the Satanic Temple hold services?
I think services would be putting it a little strongly. I think like most people, I mean, we enjoy ceremony and doing a ritual, not unlike other religions. But right now, I don't, as the chapter head of Atlanta Group, don't really have, you know, a headquarters or a church that we can do things out of. I mean, we get together and we do community service activities and things like that. But, you know, we don't really have a regular Sunday service type of situation. I mean, not that we wouldn't, but, you know, with our lack of belief in the supernatural, you know, ritual takes on somewhat of a different meaning, and it's more of a community building exercise and a social activity.
So you are, you guys have been around, this particular chapter has been around for about a year, you said.
Correct.
This has to be, to some extent, an uphill battle. I'm making that assumption. You're in Georgia.
It is. But, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that initially attracted me to the Satanic Temple itself is that we try not to fight meaningless and unwinnable battles. You know, we try and select our issues based on things which are, in our opinion, clearly expressed by the law, you know, issues of separation, church and state, and go about it in meaningful ways that hopefully can predicate a change. You know, I mean, we like to take the activism a lot further than holding up cardboard signs in the rain, you know. And so, you know, although it is an uphill battle, on the other hand, it just seems the law is so clear that eventually we're sure to prevail.
Is that, I mean, the Satanic Temple, we have about a minute left, but the Satanic Temple has been remarkably successful in the lawsuits and fights it's fought in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have teeth. We're prepared to back our actions up with, you know, application of the law based on legal action.
And do you think that's why? Because you choose, you're careful in
selecting
battles
that are winnable? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we're not just out there to tackle any old issue which happens to take, you know, our attention. We're really specially focused and designed around particular separation of church and state types of issues, which are almost always, you know, have a precedent with some other group. You know, I mean, we're trying to follow suit. In most of our actions, we're trying to follow suit with something that already exists and try and point out the discrepancy. Now, like, again, with the After School Satan Club, it sounds, you know, a lot of people will think that our main mission is to actually hold that club. In fact, a better victory for us would be for them to suspend the other clubs. That would actually be our top priority.
And have zero religious
right, exactly. That separation of church and state should be applied. And a second best alternative is that we are be allowed to hold our club as an alternative, because there is currently no alternative.
Fred Mephisto is the chapter head for the Atlanta chapter of the Satanic Temple. Fred, thank you so much.
Thank you. Hail Satan.
Just ahead, author Nathan Hill talks about his latest novel, The Nix. But first, Athens Band of Montreal is back with a new record. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Not too many indie bands can say they've gone strong for more than 20 years. Athens Group of Montreal is an exception. Founded by Kevin Barnes in the late 90s, the band has released 14 full-length albums. Number 15 is on the way. It's called White Israelic Irrealis Mood. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke with Of Montreal frontman Kevin Barnes about the new record.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. So one of the first things you notice about this album is how long the titles are. And I read your statement in which that was really intentional. How come?
Well, like, I think in general, my songs are not about one subject. They're usually about so many different things. And so if I give a song just a, you know, sort of basic title, it doesn't really embody the full spirit of the song. So I would prefer to have more like 100 titles for every song. But obviously that's just obnoxious. So two titles is still pretty obnoxious, but, you know, it's just something different.
Let's hear a little bit of music. Let's start with the music. This is the first single from the record, and it's called Paranoiac Intervals / Body Dysmorphia. They're drugging us, that's how we are here in the fogs. Murder of faces and in the prosaic analogs. You're the only one with any shock of animation. You're the only one who's worthy of my concentration. I had to draw a line in my life. There's those I have time for, there's those I don't. What's up with you? You're such a power. So you described yourself last year as being paranoid during the time of the lead-up to the election. And I wonder what you mean by that. Why do you think you were paranoid?
Well, I think Trump getting elected sort of made a tear in reality and sort of destroyed our concept of stability and forced us to reassess what life is. Like what reality is, you know, that if someone like that can become president, it just shakes everybody to the core. I mean, at least, you know, people like me, it's pretty hard to just, you know, not be impacted by that on the deepest level.
Just in case, I want to play a little bit of music to remind people of who you are. So let's play a tune that probably a lot of people know. The name of the song is Wraith Pinned to the Mist and Other Games. It's from your 2005 record, and it ended up being used in some popular commercials. Let's pretend we don't exist. Let's pretend we're in Antarctica. Let's have bizarre celebrations. Let's forget when, forget what, forget how. We'll have bizarre celebrations. We'll play Justin and Isolde, but make sure I see white sail. How do you find that balance? Because there's a lot of indie bands that say that they refuse to go commercial, right? They won't sell their music to a commercial. And it could be that those are the kind of bands that don't get asked to sell their music. But I wonder how you do the balance between, say, high art in one case and something that's used on a T-Mobile commercial.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's tricky because I would definitely prefer to never have my music played in commercials and for it to stay pure for people, you know. Just this line of work doesn't pay very well. And, you know, if you want to be able to focus all of your attention on creating art, you do sort of have to make some sacrifices on that level and just hope it doesn't ruin you in people's minds.
Does it change at all the way you write music?
No, not really, just because it just feels sort of like a happy accident if, for whatever reason, the capitalist world wants to incorporate me into their scheme. You know, because most of the time it just doesn't happen. Like, I haven't been asked to put a song in a commercial in probably 10 years. So that was just kind of like this brief little window where, for whatever reason, I was being incorporated into that world, the corporate world, and then they've moved on, which is fine with me.
Well, let's hear another tune that was used in a commercial. This is a Gronlandic edit. It's from a year 2007 record, Hissing Fauna, Are You the Destroyer? I guess it would be nice to give my heart to a god, but which one? Church is filled with losers, psycho or confused. I just want to hold the dear in and forget all of the beauties wasted. So, you know, yours is the kind of band where it's mostly you, but you've had a changing of personnel over the years. Some musicians have come and some have gone, and I wonder how you think that's affected your sound, or if it has.
Yeah, definitely anyone who's involved creatively is going to impact the sound of what I do. And like you said, I've been the one constant throughout, but I mean, it's kind of, you know, when I first started making music in my parents, you know, in my parents' house, in my bedroom, the way that I went about it at that time and the fulfillment that I received from it just sort of carried over to present day. You know, it's a, sort of the same process and the same experience.
Wait, I want to be clear. I'm understanding you. You use the same process for making music as when you were a young kid making songs in your parents' house?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just like, you know, writing a song on the guitar or the piano and then, you know, getting the four, at that time it would have been a cassette four track, and now, you know, I use a 24 track analog tape machine, or sometimes I use my computer. And but it's basically the same process of just getting lost in the headphones and creating art and losing track of time and space, and, you know, coming out of it 8 hours later feeling dizzy and excited about what I've done. And it's cool working with other people because they contribute things that I would never think of myself, and they're able to just add another element to the project. So I like to work with different people and not, you know, work with the same people, because sometimes it can feel, I feel like it's dangerous when people have a role to play and they feel like, hey, that's my role. And if someone else does that, then they feel like they've been cheated out of something. And so it's better, I think, to keep things fresh and for people not to get too comfortable, you know, myself as well. I always try to challenge myself to explore different avenues, different kinds of music, different genres, and I don't limit myself. It's like, oh, this is my sound, or this is like the true sound, or whatever. I always want to like almost become a new artist, or have the band feel like a new band with each record.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Kevin Barnes. He's frontman for the Athens Group of Montreal, and they're going to play at Savannah Stopover on March 10th. I wonder if your group, your sound, could be as changeable as it is during the days of record stores, right? Is it partly the new way that we get music now that allows bands like yours to you know, be indefinable?
I feel like we're sort of old school enough that, you know, because we've been putting out records pre-internet, so
yeah,
it's not like we're not like a product of the present time or anything like that. So I don't think it has impacted us at all, but I don't really know how it has impacted us. I mean, like, people don't buy records anymore. They just stream music, and you get, like, the tiniest fraction of a penny for every stream. So the money situation is totally different. But when we were putting out, you know, before the internet, nobody was buying our records anyway. So we only had a brief window where anybody was buying our records. So now we're back to not selling any. But we still, you know, so you just have to go on tour a lot, and that's how you earn your living.
But you wrote that you kind of gave up on the live band in a room approach for this record. What does that mean?
Well, so the last couple of records, I was really into the idea of getting a group of people together and everyone's personality being showcased and creating something communal with a group of people, and wanting it to feel, you know, spontaneous, impulsive, and alive, and not labor over it like I do when I'm making things that are more of like a solo effort, because it's just the nature of working by yourself. You just have to spend so many months just fine-tuning everything. Well, you don't have to, but I tend to do that. So for those previous records, the last couple of records, I wanted to make something that felt more immediate and involved more people. And then with this record, kind of went back to the sort of meditative process of working by myself and being alone in the studio for so many weeks at a time, and then incorporating other people as well, but in sort of a more remote sense of like sending somebody a mix and asking them to create something in their home studio, and then send it back to me, and then I incorporate that into the project and all that. So it's kind of had been, this record is definitely more of a solo record in that sense.
So let's hear a little more music from the new record. This song is called Riding the Circles / Orgone Tropics. I mean, most of your music has always been pretty thoughtful, but this album in particular seems to it doesn't surprise me at all, I guess, that for a good part of it, you were sort of isolated in thinking. because a lot of it seems to be pretty meditative in a way. And I wonder if you would talk about the title of the album and what it means. It seems to have come out of a long process of thought for you.
Yeah, so I separated from my wife, or my wife and I separated, maybe 3-4 years ago, and just went through this long period of self-exploration and kind of self-education, and had a lot of time to research things and to explore parts of the human experience and other people's human experience as well, and just kind of learn about my species in a way, and learn about the United States of America, and just kind of put things into a perspective that was different from where I was at, you know, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago. And just did a lot of reading. I read Malcolm X's autobiography. I read a bunch of James Baldwin's novels and essays, and got into Alan Watts and Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky, and, you know, just sort of tried to understand, because I feel like in the United States, we're definitely, there's always a veil over everyone's eyes. It's sort of, you're given it. It's sort of the original sin of being born in the United States is to have the veil put over your eyes, and you, it's really difficult to get beyond it. But you have to, like, get deeper into educating yourself, because you're not going to receive that education in the public school system or even in college necessarily. So, but there are these great authors out there, and they're great thinkers and people that can sort of cleanse your mind and help you see things in the way that they actually are. So I just spent this, you know, extended period of time educating myself. And then also within that process, I fell in love and met someone really wonderful. There's this, I think, a great hopefulness on the album, which I hope is more powerful than this sort of cynicism that's also there of sort of realizing that I've been betrayed and lied to my whole life by people who are trying to create a homogenous society of consumers and creators of waste.
So let's hear another track from the upcoming album. This one's called Soft Music, Juno Portraits of the Jovian Sky.
Wrecked another weekend. You don't know me though. Soft music jams the oxygen.
So to me, I keep hearing throughout a lot of these songs this, I guess, a plea for authenticity, not just in love, but in all things, in a way. And for me, that represents a new sound for you. I mean, I wonder if you think this album is a new direction.
It's definitely a direction, but just my nature, I think, prevents me from moving too far in one direction without... I just tend to get bored and restless, you know. Even if I'm moving in the right direction, I get bored with that, and then I want to go in the wrong direction for a period of time.
So the next album may be the wrong direction for all we know?
Yeah, maybe. It's sort of like, I just started meditating and learning more about Zen Buddhism, and it's interesting to me that people are sort of aspiring toward an enlightened state. I don't know if I really want to become enlightened to the sense of being finished. You know, there's something about finishing that seems scary to me. I think I like creating things, blowing them up, creating new things, blowing them up, creating new things, blowing them up. And I kind of like the karmic cycle.
Well, maybe that would mean that you like being flawed in some ways.
Yeah, there's something about that is fun, you know, like, but I'm sure it's fun to be enlightened too. I don't know. Maybe it's not like I have a choice. I'll just be flawed and never be enlightened.
Kevin Barnes is the frontman for the Athens Group of Montreal. Their 15th record is called White is Relic / Irieles Mood. It's out on March 9th. You can see them play Savannah Stopover on March 10th or in their hometown of Athens at the 40 Watt on March 22nd. Such a pleasure, Kevin. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Just ahead, what is the Knicks? Author Nathan Hill sheds some light. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. The Knicks is Nathan Hill's debut novel. It's the story of a woman who threw gravel at a governor and also the story of the son that she abandoned. And the New York Times called it the great American novel. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke with author Nathan Hill last year.
Hi there.
So, how do you respond to being called the great American novel? Is that what you set out to write?
No, not at all. Yeah, I started this this book a long time ago. 2004 is when I first started writing this book. And hilariously, I thought I was writing a short story at the time. And it just kind of grew and grew and grew.
Hilariously, because listeners may not realize, this is quite a thick book.
It is. I hope that it reads quicker than it looks. But it's about, you know, it's about 600 pages. But I hope that I try to give the reader a pretty good experience along the way.
I think a lot of people like books that they can really sort of sink into.
I know I do. Yeah, I like to really kind of, I don't know, get really involved. I like to feel like I'm in somebody else's mind and in somebody else's family. So yeah, big books. I guess I just kind of wrote the kind of book that I like to read.
What was the short story? I mean, I'm interested now. Because there's a lot of threads in this novel, and I'm going to try very, very hard not to do any spoilers during this interview. But which was the short story focused on?
Yeah, I always feel sorry for people who have to explain what this book is about, because there's a lot of stuff going on. At the heart of it, it's about a mother and a son, as you mentioned. The mother is named Faye. Her son is named Samuel. And Faye leaves the family when Samuel is 11 years old. And he doesn't see her again for a little more than 20 years until one day she's on the internet in a kind of viral video. And he decides to try to figure out not only what she's doing,
but only because there's major financial incentive to do
there's
so.
He's contracted to write an expose of his own mom to savage her very publicly and write a book about her. And then he discovers this big epic story that he never knew existed. I started the story in 2004. After I just moved to New York City, this was August 2004, and one of the things that happened my first month in the city was that the Republicans were having their presidential nominating convention at Madison Square Garden, and this was Bush Cheney's second term. The war in Iraq was ongoing, and so a lot of people came down to protest. And so I was like, "That's going to be interesting." So I went and watched the protests, and then promptly started writing a story about a guy who is one of the protesters.
I assume that either you play World of Warcraft or you know someone quite well who does, because there's information in there, like the fact that Tuesday's patch day and you don't get to play the game again until like 3 p.m. Eastern time. For those listening, if you don't play World of Warcraft, it's an MMORPG. That's a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. And it is... it plays a fairly crucial role in the story, because this is how Samuel meets... Pwnage, which is his online name. But you used to play...
Well, it sounds like you're quite familiar with it, too.
I am very familiar with it, yes.
You just outed yourself. you know what? Okay, so I started playing in 2004, about the same time I started writing the book. And the reason I started playing was because my first month in the city, this thing happened to me where my computer was stolen. And it was stolen out of my car on a day that I was moving apartments. And that computer had all of my writing from my graduate program. So like 3 years of writing and a manuscript in process was suddenly gone one day, and I had to start writing something new. And I was quite sad about that. And eventually,
never got it back.
I never got it back. Yeah. So eventually, I saved up enough money for another computer, and things weren't going well, as you can imagine. Things weren't going very well for me in the city. And I had a good friend. He calls me one day and he says, "Hey, I want you to buy this game, World of Warcraft." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Just don't worry about it. Just buy it." And he told me later that he did it only to kind of keep an eye on me. You know, like I was really sad and alone in the city, and we could chat
Yeah, you can chat while you're in the, and you can see when someone comes online and goes offline. And I want to read this because it might be the best description I've ever read of why video games like this are popular among adults. You say, quote, "If only the real world operated like Elfscape. When I was a jerk to Lisa, I'd lose points, and the closer I was to zero, the closer I'd be to divorce. It would also be helpful if these events came with associated sound effects, like that sound when Pac-Man shrivels up and dies." Like the world in a game like that, you know when you're doing something positive or something negative, and it's all about points. But this novel is very much about uncertainties and unspoken things and people being unsure of how other people feel. How did that, for you in your mind, how did you pull that from World of Warcraft?
That is such a great question. I wrote the lion's share of the novel during the recession. And this was a time when it just felt like things were unraveling, you know, like all the old rules were going away. You know, you could lose your retirement nest egg in a second. Your house was suddenly worth half as much as you paid for it. And people were getting laid off. Unemployment was high. And it just felt like everything was kind of coming undone. But then I would think about my time playing this game and how linear it was, how hard work paid off. If you did enough, you would increase your level and you would get better and better and better. And there was a kind of payoff for hard work that seemed to be now irrelevant in the real world. And so that tension between what I saw happening to folks around me, to friends and relatives, and then what would happen in a game, it gave me the inspiration for this character who prefers being in the game to the real world.
Well, because the real world has not been particularly kind of him, possibly
right
on his own fault. But let's talk about the title, which is the Nyx. And it's based on a Nordic myth that Samuel's mother heard from her father. And correct me if I have this wrong, but the Nyx originally was a horse that would lure children to ride it, and then it would lure them to their deaths, basically. It would
That's
jump
right.
off a cliff.
That's right.
And then eventually the Nyx is not a horse anymore. It's anything that is too good to be true. The connection, it's very difficult for me to separate that from not only the recession that you were talking about, but the what's happening in the world right now. It's very much of the moment.
Yeah, the Nyx, it's spelled N-I-X, by the way. I have to do that or else people think I've written a basketball novel. As the story goes, the horse would present itself to these kids. And I was thinking about it from the kids' point of view. And when suddenly they got their own horse, it must have been the coolest thing that ever happened to them. And then, of course, tragedy struck. And it seemed relevant to me for a couple different reasons. First, as a metaphor for what was going on with my characters, all of them are sort of undermined by the very things that mean the most to them. So Samuel is undermined by the mother who abandons him. Ponage is undermined by the very video game that he's obsessed with, and so on and
Bishop
so forth.
Bishop was undermined by the military he obsessed over
right.
as a child.
Right, and Bethany is by her own twin brother. Is disowned by her own twin brother, and there's a character who is a workaholic who is then undermined by the very company he's been working for.
Yeah, gets sick.
Yeah, that's right. And so, but then in a kind of larger sense, it struck me while I was writing this that one of the reasons why the recession was so systemic was because of our trust in things we thought were too good to be true. You know, things like AAA rated mortgage backed securities and sovereign debt and so on. These things that we thought these will never go down suddenly went down. And so it was, you know, in part a reaction to what was going on, that one of the reasons why it was such a disaster is because we believed in things that were too good to be true.
Is the Nyx a real Nordic myth?
It is, yeah. It's known by different names. It's Scandinavian and Germanic. Every culture has a slightly different name for it. It's the Nyx or the Noxen or the Nocken, the Neck, the Nixie. It depends on where you're coming from, but it is a real story.
Either way, it's still the moral is don't trust things that are too good to be true.
That's right.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with author Nathan Hill. His debut novel is The Nyx, N-I-X. So The whole, well, not the whole middle, but there's a large chunk in the middle, which is a choose your own adventure, but there's no choice in it until the very end. And it struck me that in a way, that's another running theme in the novel, is this idea of choice that's not really choice. There's a part where Samuel's going talk about the choice to go to New York City, and he says, how could it be a decision when you never considered saying no? But that's true of so many people in this novel. Did that also come from personal experience?
It did. I know that when I was a kid, I loved those Choose Your Own Adventure books. You know,
and, I wondered about that.
Yeah, and yeah. When I would read them, I would put my thumb in an important decision and kind of look ahead and see if I was making the right
decision.
I totally cheated. And see if I made the right decision. And then if it looked like I made the wrong decision, I would like flip back. You know, and it struck
before
me
before you died.
Yeah, that's right. It struck me that that Samuel is looking back on this time that he went to New York City to try to win the heart of a woman that he's in love with and failed. And it struck me that he must be thinking about that the sort of the way I used to think about the choose, like, if only I would have made a better choice. And so when I decided to write that section, I'm like, of course I'll write it as a choose your own adventure section. But those things don't feel like you're choosing your own adventure at the time. It feels like you're just kind of going with the flow. It feels like you're in a river and there's not much you can do about it, but kind of go with the current. And so, yeah, so it's a choose your own adventure section that has no choices until the very end. And then you're given a doozy.
So, I mean, so many novels, we just talked to a fiction writer who said, if enough author tells you that they aren't writing about themselves, they're lying to you. So many novels, you pull things from your own personal life or things that you've observed. And I wonder if anybody that you know saw themselves in this book and came back to you and said, what the heck?
Well, I had to warn my mom. So, of course, the book is about a mother who is kind of cold and distant,
yeah,
and who abandons her family. And my own mom is warm and supportive and has never abandoned anything. So I had to warn her that she's going to find things that are pretty familiar, because when I was writing that character, you know, she's a fictional character, but I wrap her up in a lot of real details. Like most of the characters, a lot of stuff from my own life or my parents' lives or my friends' lives, I steal and put in the book. So, yeah, so Faye comes from the same small Iowa river town that my mom comes from. And I had to tell her, you're going to see things that are familiar, but this is not you. Fortunately, she took that advice well, and she's a big fan of the book now. But I had to warn her.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about Molly Miller. Mm-hmm. So Molly Miller in the book is this pop singer who's ostensibly 17, but is actually 25. And she writes this, what sounds like an awful song, in which the repeated line is, you've got to represent. And nobody actually knows what that means. Do you hate pop music?
That's a great question. I don't. I just know that there's a lot of music out there that has, let's say, an ambiguous relationship with meaning. And in Molly Miller struck me as a way I could talk about kind of pop culture's obsession with facade. You know, she is all glitz, all glamour, but at the heart of it, there's kind of nothing going on in her music. You know, and she is produced by this media guru who ends up being a big character.
Yeah, he's a jerk. Yeah,
a big character in the novel, and he's kind of like, you know, he's that promoter who doesn't care.
Craven.
Yeah, he doesn't care what he promotes. It's just the message. As long as the message gets out, you know, he could be selling cigarettes. He doesn't care that they're bad for you. He just wants people to smoke more because that is his job. You know, he just gets the message out. And it kind of struck me that there's, like you said, like a kind of cravenness to media culture sometimes, where it's really just about, like, fame is the point, you know, and not, there's nothing kind of behind it.
So that kind of brings us to what I kind of felt was the undercurrent of the whole novel, which is the death of empathy in our world. You start early. There's this elite neighborhood that where they used a trick to build on a protected wetland. They put out salt licks to poison the deer, but just it acts slowly enough so that they return to the woods before they die. I mean, it's just awful. But that runs through the whole novel, this fact that people just don't have empathy for each other anymore. And I it made me wonder about whether or not you've kind of lost hope. I mean, if you write a 600-page novel, that's an expression of hope, is it not? But on the other hand, the book is a little bit sad?
It is. Yeah, that's such a great question, and you're among the only people who have who's put it exactly that way, and you're precisely right. I was worried about that while I was writing the book. I know that. You're kind of writing by instinct, kind of writing by gut, you know, for a long time until you get several hundred pages down, and then you kind of realize what you've been saying all along. And one of the things I realized was that this was really, I thought it was going to be a book about politics when I first started it, but it turns out it's a book sort of more about polarization. And, you know, it's there are protests in 1968 and 2004. There's a guy who can't see beyond his own video game avatar. There's a college student who really can't see beyond her own social media image. You know, there are people who have created sort of bubbles for themselves and have trouble communicating with anybody outside of that bubble. So once I realized that's what I was writing about, I took a lot of opportunities to place it, to, you know, kind of make it a more aggressive theme. And you're right, that neighborhood is a great example.
It is. It's kind of the metaphor, the whole thing.
I guess your question about being hopeful, I don't know. I guess yes, because I feel like I end the novel in a more hopeful place. You know, yeah. I feel like I end the novel.
No spoilers.
I won't give it away, but I didn't want it to be a downer. I guess I can spoil that. I hope the ending is not a downer, because a lot of the characters learn to kind of see beyond the kind of unbreathable ideologies that they've been living in all along.
And what did it make you think? Did it make you rethink your own bubble that you lived in?
It did. I wanted the ending to be a reflection of the things that I learned along the way. There are a lot of characters in this novel that started as very two-dimensional and what I see now as caricatures of maybe people I might disagree with. And then it was clear that I had a certain kind of authorial disdain for those characters, and they just were not coming alive. And so I'm like, you know what? If I'm going to be a proper author, if I'm going to write a book that people are going to care about, I'm going to have to ask certain questions about these folks' lives. And that naturally leads you into more empathy when you start asking, well, why is this person behaving this way? Why do they think what they think and I think what I think? And ultimately, I chose this story about the blind men and the elephant for the epigraph that kind of sums up where I got to eventually. If you don't know the story, there's a king who asks all the blind men in a town to touch a part of the elephant, and then he asks them all, what is an elephant like? And of course they all have different answers.
Tree trunk or yeah.
And so it struck me as a very tidy metaphor for kind of what's going on, that people are touching very different parts of the elephant.
That's novelist Nathan Hill speaking with Celeste Headlee last year. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. We're asking what your favorite Celeste Headlee segments are. She is stepping down as host of this program. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can post to Twitter. We're at OST Talk, and we're on Facebook. The show page is just On Second Thought on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.